Some of you listening are to be commended for your patience. I first promised some 17 months ago that I'd get around to answering this burning question, and now we're finally here. Today's primary passage for discussion will be Exodus chapter 21, particularly verses 1 through 6, 16, 20, and 26 through 27. We will also add references to several other passages to this one. We will do this in an attempt to get a basic understanding of what the law of Moses says concerning slavery. It is a controversial topic, no doubt, but as with all topics in the scripture, controversial or not, we will not shy away from it. And, of course, we have no reason to do so, as a careful examination of the scriptures will demonstrate to us that the biblical take on slavery is perhaps not so antagonistic to the modern ideology as it may seem. So then, if you have not yet read Exodus 21, then you should do so now. Now, in that passage, you did not read about the abolition of slavery. And on that point, every atheist, humanist, or person otherwise antagonistic to the Bible will immediately leap up and shout, "Look at how horrible the Bible is! The God of the Bible is so backward and monstrous that he actually supports slavery!" And I have to chuckle a little to myself when I hear that argument because it is so silly. But let's run with it for a moment. Let's suppose, for the sake of discussion, that the God of the Bible actually does support and is a big proponent of slavery. Well, even if that were the case, the atheist has still made a pretty severe error in that he accuses God of immorality, despite the fact that God is the immutable moral standard. The atheist has no moral standard. The difference between right and wrong for an atheist is nothing more than what he and the people around him believe ought to be right or wrong, and that standard shifts with the breeze. So the atheist says that slavery is wrong, and in so doing he presumes that God must also be wrong. Well, we as believers know different. We know that God is always right, and that God is the standard of morality. So if God says that something is moral and right and good, then that thing is moral and right and good. If we accept, and I think it would be short-sighted to do so, that God proudly and fully endorses slavery, then we must accept that his endorsement is good. On those grounds, the attack against God falls flat on its face. Of course, atheist arguments tend to fall flat when they're attempting to convince Christians of anything, because atheists tend to tailor their arguments not to something that is convincing, but to what other atheists want to hear. Have you ever noticed that? They'll say goofy things like, "Oh, so you believe the Bible? Well, you'd better not eat any shellfish then, ho ho ho." As if there are any Christians who don't understand that dietary restrictions are abrogated in the New Testament, and as if the argument will actually convince some of us that we're wrong. Like, we're going to say, "Oh, woe is me. There are some verses in the Bible acknowledging the existence of slavery and restricting the eating of certain foods. Whatever shall we do?" I think the atheists all know that we aren't just going to throw our Bibles in the trash over that. And if they aren't trying to convince us with the line, then they must either be showing off or just trying to antagonize us. So, let's give the Bible its due consideration and determine what God's opinion on slavery really is. In the first place, I think we would do well to remind ourselves of the context. The people of Israel, who are receiving this law from God, were, not more than a few months before receiving this, freed from slavery in the most overt display of God's power throughout all of human history. The idea, then, that God is a big-time fan of slavery doesn't exactly mesh well. If he's such a huge fan of slavery, he might have just left the Hebrews captive in Egypt, and that would have been the end of that. The law of Moses is also very conscious of the fact that Israel was only recently released from slavery. From the beginning of the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20 to the end of Deuteronomy, the law of Moses mentions that God delivered the people of Israel from slavery in Egypt over a dozen times. So both God and Israel have freedom from slavery as a major theme on their minds as these laws are being recounted. Not only that, but we see that the law of Moses corrects many of the errors that were committed in Pharaoh's Egypt. For example, the people of Egypt were made subject to Pharaoh after he drove all the people into debt and then scooped up their land in repayment. Well, we'll find in the Law of Moses that God declares himself ultimate owner of the land and sets forth provisions to ensure that it doesn't ever become centralized as it was under Pharaoh. You can see Leviticus chapter 25, verse 23 for a source on that. Pharaoh was also cruel to the babes of Egypt, callously killing them. Well, the Law of Moses demands that the people not kill their children in idolatrous sacrifices, and even demands in this very chapter that there be accountability for a person who accidentally harms an unborn child. We have noted in the past that God's law is the practical earthly solution to the problem of sin, and this solution became immediately necessary because of how deeply entrenched in sin Pharaoh's Egypt had become. We can even make the argument that the Law of Moses is God's direct reaction against Pharaoh's tyrannies. And of course, in addition to those reactions listed above, we have today's topic of discussion: limitations and regulations placed on slavery that effectively take the teeth out of it. God didn't want slavery like happened in Pharaoh's Egypt, and that's why here, close to the outset of the law, we have regulations regarding slavery. So make no mistake, that's what we're talking about here. These aren't open advocations that slavery is good, that it should be practiced, or that it should be done without strict oversight. Much to the contrary. These laws, and others throughout the Old Testament and through all the Bible, place limitations on slavery. In fact, I cannot think of a single passage anywhere in the Bible that expands or deregulates or encourages the practice of slavery. Anytime that we find slavery mentioned in the Bible is giving rights to the slaves and taking rights away from the slave owners. So I don't want to hear any nonsense about how the God of the Bible is the God of slavery. That is an illiterate person's opinion. Now, before we jump into exactly what regulations are being placed on slavery here, it seems good to me that we should consider just what slavery was and how it was practiced at the time. Allow me to skip ahead to Exodus chapter 22, verse 3, which relates a penalty for stealing. In that verse, it is said that the thief must pay restitution, and notes that if the thief cannot repay, he is to be sold to pay his debt. And that, I assert, is the primary cause of slavery in ancient Israel. Slavery was primarily instituted so that criminals could repay their debts. Today, the humanist world keeps their criminals in cages to rot at great expense to the taxpayers. But in Israel, they were much more generous, and they gave the criminals an opportunity to regain their dignity by working off their crimes. Ideally, those criminals also learned some job skills while they were at it, so that they would not need to steal anymore, and the victim of the crime was repaid for his loss. Crime was not the only reason, though, that a person might become a slave. Proverbs 22:7 tells us that the borrower is a slave to the lender, and in this case it literally becomes true. Leviticus 25:39-40 tells us that an Israeli brother might become poor and sell himself as a slave. The passage notes that while the person is technically a slave, he is not to be treated as a slave might be treated. Rather, he is to be treated as if he is a hired worker. And this arrangement is beneficial to the poor person. Left to himself, he had fallen into debt which he could not repay, and he was unable to provide for himself. While serving as a slave, the poor person would be provided for by his master. He would get himself out of debt, and he would learn some new skills and gain some experience that would keep him from falling back into that debt. And of course, as we see an example in Deuteronomy 21:10-14, slaves were taken of foreign people in warfare. A person who fights a war, then, might have ended up on the losing side and found himself or his kin paying war reparations through labor. So that's what slavery was about. By some sort of misbehavior, or by waste, or maybe just by having an inability to care for oneself, a person would owe a debt, and either he or his kin would be sold to pay it off. That person would then work for a master for a period of time, and the master would provide for the slave's basic needs. This is different from, but not incomparable to, how debts are handled in modern society. For example, many criminals are considered to owe a debt to society, and as such, they are often compelled to serve out a period of years in service to the state. This isn't the equivalent of paying a reparation directly to the victim, But the same general concept of slavery in the place of reparation is at play. The prison slaves' living conditions are harsh, and prisoners are generally not doing work of much value, but it is a form of slavery as defined in the Bible nonetheless. There are others who borrow money and go into debt, and they are generally required to work and pay that money back. They have more freedom in choosing what kind of work they want to do, so they aren't literally slaves, but they have a slavish existence nonetheless. Of course, debtors in the Anglophone world who can't pay their debts aren't sold into slavery. They declare bankruptcy. In bankruptcy, the debtor is either released from his debts or makes managed payments to help get him out of debt, and of course he is saddled with a reputation of having bad credit. That, I suppose, is a relatively generous way of dealing with that problem, and one which is quite unfair to the lender who will be out some money. The existence of bankruptcy also lends itself to some degree of irresponsibility among borrowers, who, rather than becoming slaves and learning to right their financial house, might just go on declaring bankruptcy over and again and financially benefiting from it. I can think of at least one case where a particular serial bankrupter became wealthy enough by taking advantage of this system that he managed to become president. But I digress. Of course, lenders are engaged in some unfair practices of their own, but finances are another consideration for another day. And war reparations, for which the Bible justifies slavery, have been common even in modern history. Germany paid reparations to the Allies after World War II, as did Japan. Iraq paid reparations after the Gulf War, etc., etc. So debt slavery has existed in one form or another for all of human history, and it will continue to exist whether or not we call it by other names. The Bible says slave, we say prisoner or debtor or what have you. So it might be unpopular to say the word slavery when we read it in the Bible, but it is really not so unreasonable or far removed from modern practice as it may initially appear. So, much as modern codes have regulations regarding prisons or bankruptcy, the law of Moses has regulations to restrain slavery. So let's have a look at some of those regulations, and then compare them with modern practice. First, let's note plainly that people, under the law of Moses, were not simply taken and enslaved without some just cause. As we have mentioned above, slavery in the Old Testament was about repayment of debt, not about force. This wasn't one race of people kidnapping from another race of people, or about beating people into submission. This was about a person who owed a debt working that debt off. Care of Exodus 21:16, anyone who steals a man and sells him, that is, taking him as a slave without a proper debt justification, earns himself a death penalty. So people could not just be snatched up and claimed as slaves. That's not how it worked. People who tried to pull that stunt would end up dead. And we have two attestations to this. Deuteronomy 24:7 requires the same penalty. If a person kidnaps and enslaves a person, then he gets the death penalty. And Deuteronomy notes that enforcing this heavy penalty will purge the evil from the midst of Israel. So slavery was for debtors and criminals, not ordinary people, and slavery was accomplished as a legal transaction, not by brute force. Slavery was also limited in that there was a maximum time span of 6 years for which a person could be enslaved. According to Exodus 21:2, a male slave could serve for only 6 years and had to be released in the seventh year. Now, Deuteronomy 15, verses 12 through 18 give the same stipulation and add that a female slave was to be treated in the same way. Now, that may seem contradictory with what you've already read from Exodus 21, but be patient because we'll get to that. Deuteronomy also commands the slave master to be generous with his slave when he sends him out. The master is told to lend and to give to his former slave freely, surely with the expectation that the newly freed man should be able to stand and work on his own. The passage lists that the master should give to the freed man from his flock, from his threshing floor, and from his winepress. Slaves were not to go out empty-handed. Both Exodus and Deuteronomy record a method by which the slavery could continue beyond the seventh year, however. We know that many who fell into slavery at this time were poor, and that this was the original cause of their slavery. Well, during their time of slavery, the slaves were often treated like valuable employees, and many of them surely lived comfortable, happy lives as they worked. They also became attached to the work that they did, and to the master who provided work and sustenance for them. Masters also sometimes gave comfort women to their slaves from their own harems, and these women stayed with the master if the slave left, since, for better or worse, they were the master's women. For this reason, many slaves would decide in the seventh year not to leave, but to continue working for the master. If a slave decided to do this, there was a method for committing to the arrangement. Both parties would have to be willing to engage in this agreement. First, they would go before God, evidently to the temple where the decision would be recorded, and if they were in agreement and the slave openly voiced that he wanted to stay with the master, then the master would stand the slave up by the doorpost of the house and pierce his ear by driving an awl through the ear and into the doorpost. Now, it would be very difficult to cleanly pierce someone's ear against a doorpost if he was unwilling, so the slave had to have clearly made his mind up here. The slave then, we presume, would wear an earring to preserve the hole in his ear, demonstrating that he was entitled to the benefits given by the master and had willingly declared his intent to continue giving his service. If the servant ever tried to deny the arrangement, then the master needed only to point to the hole in the slave's ear, which corresponded perfectly in height, with a blood-stained hole on his own doorpost. In this way, anyone could recognize a person who had committed to a life of service and could match the person with the master. So that is what happened at the end of the sixth year of service. We note next another exception, that of the slave wife. In Exodus 21, verses 7 through 11, we find a distinction between male and female slaves. Some females might be bought simply for their service. Others might be bought with the intention of being kept as wives. This tracks well with what we've seen of marriage elsewhere, in which a man who desired to marry a girl paid her father for her hand. Obviously, a girl purchased as a wife would not be put out from her husband in the seventh year. She was to be treated as a wife, and if she was given to the purchaser's son, was to be treated as a daughter. Deuteronomy 21, verses 10 through 14, records similar treatment for women captured as slaves for war reparations, noting specifically that they could not be sold or treated like slaves. Exodus 21:8 records that if the girl is betrothed to her master but not yet consummated to him, and he decides not to consummate, then he must allow her family to redeem her rather than selling her to foreigners. We haven't gotten to redemption yet, but the basic idea is that the family can buy her back. Now in verses 10 and 11, we find a circumstance in which the betrothed slave wife can leave the situation without a restitution, and this corrects a certain loophole. A crafty man might realize that he could keep a female slave forever, if only he claimed that he wanted her for a wife, but then failed to actually take her as one. The seventh year would come, he would say, "Yeah, I'm going to consummate with her soon enough," and then he'd just keep working her as a slave. Well, in verses 10 and 11, we see that the girl would be free to go if the man demonstrated a failure to treat her as a wife. To demonstrate that failure, the man would have to do two things. First, he would have to take another slave girl as a wife, and second, he would have to diminish the first girl's standard of living. He would do this by either diminishing her food, or her clothing, or her cohabitation. Now, exactly what is meant by cohabitation is unclear. This is the only instance of the word in the Bible, and it comes evidently from a root which is unused elsewhere. It could mean that he stops having or refuses to ever have sex with the girl. It could mean that he puts the girl out of the house, or it could mean that he downgrades her to a smaller living quarters to provide for the new girl. Whatever the case, if a man claims that he's going to marry a girl so that he can make a slave of her, but then demonstrates that he has no intention of marrying her by marrying another wife and then giving a low standard of living to the first one, it's obvious that this is just an attempt to unjustly keep a slave forever, and so she's free to go. So anyway, unless a slave was a woman bought as a wife, that slave went free after the sixth year. However, we should note that in most cases, not even a six-year period of service would be permitted. According to Leviticus 25:40, slaves were to be released in the seventh year. Now, we haven't talked about the Sabbath year yet, but it came once every 7 years, just as the Sabbath day came once every 7 days, and it would be the same seventh year for everyone. So, the only way that a slave would serve a full 6 years would be if he was purchased at the very beginning of the seven-year cycle. If a person was purchased in the fifth year of the cycle, there would be only 1 year left before the seventh, and all slaves went free in the seventh year. So, the maximum that that person bought in the fifth year would serve would be only 1 year. With all that in mind, no slave served a term of slavery longer than 6 years, and many served terms considerably shorter than that. Of course, even a person with a 6-year term of slavery could be released much sooner by a redeemer. We find in Leviticus 25, verses 47 through 55, that a redeemer was a relative who could choose to buy a person out of slavery, and he is given an absolute right to do so. The slave's master couldn't reject the offer. There were set redemption prices for which slaves could be purchased by redeemers, and those were calculated based on the number of years remaining until the Jubilee. So if a slave had a term to serve, it might be made considerably shorter if a wealthy relative wanted the slave set free. He could show up to meet the slave owner, pay him a set amount, and have his kinsmen back. Now, we must note one exception to these rules limiting the duration of slavery. They applied in the law of Moses only to God's people, the Israelites. The Gentiles, those people not in the nation of Israel, did not have protections against lifetimes or even generations of slavery. Leviticus 25, verses 44 through 46 specifically note that foreigners bought as slaves could be kept indefinitely, and even their children after them. This could raise a lot of questions about nationalism and application of laws to, for example, resident aliens or foreign combatants, but that would be a discussion for another day. The point here is that God's people, as worshippers of the one true God, were given special protections that were not extended to the idolaters outside the fold. Today, of course, Christians are God's new nation, care of verses like 1 Peter 2:9. Believers in Christ have extended to them special privileges that other people don't have, so the moral of the story here is that if you want special privileges, you should join us. Becoming a Christian isn't hard. But all the talk of how long slaves had to stay with their masters is really a moot point, because if a slave decided to run away, he could still do so at will, even if he was a Gentile. Take a quick look at Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 15. In that verse, we have a command not to return an escaped slave to his master. Well, if slaves are permitted to escape at any time and no one is allowed to compel them to return, we ultimately end up in a spot where this slavery isn't really akin to the modern idea of slavery at all. The modern idea you get when you hear the word slavery is that people are being forced to work against their will. However, here we find that slaves were free to just get up and leave and no one could stop them. On those grounds, the slaves might be better called servants, and indeed, some modern translations do call them bond servants. So, we've considered what this so-called slavery looks like, and it really doesn't look like slavery at all. Under the law of Moses, slaves worked voluntarily to pay off a debt. They could be held to that debt for no more than 6 years. A family member could buy the debtor out of his debt at any time. The conditions of the debtor's service were, at least in some instances, good enough that the debtor would elect to stay in the service of the master even after the debt was repaid and he was free to go. And even if the slave did choose to go when the debt was repaid, the master was required to give to him generously on his departure. So you've heard the critique that the God of the Bible is profoundly harsh and racist and a supporter of slavery. But when you compare what the Bible records as slavery to what modern English speakers think of as slavery, you get two completely different things. The slavery of those times was also gentler than what had been practiced in Egypt. For example, there were limitations on the beating of a misbehaving slave. Care of Exodus 21, verse 20, a master who beat his slave to death would face a death penalty like any other murderer. That, as we see in verse 21, is only if the slave died that same day. If the slave lived longer than that, remembering that they did not have any medical care comparable to what we might receive today, then most likely the beating itself wouldn't have been what killed him anyway. Of course, beating a slave at all was not the best way to deal with him. Seeing that they could run away without consequence, they would have no motivation to hang around with a master who beats them. And besides, a worker who has been mistreated doesn't perform as well as one who has been treated well. Positive reinforcements, that is, rewards, tend to make for better behavior than do whippings. Aside from that, Israeli slaves were dependent on their masters. So if a slave was injured and made to lie in bed while he healed, or if he required medical care, it would be the master who is responsible for paying for it. Not only this, but beating a slave was risky. Verses 26 and 27 tell us that if a slave was beaten such that he suffered a permanent injury like the loss of a tooth or the loss of an eye, that he was to be set free. So a master would have no motivation to severely beat a slave. If he did so, he would only be costing himself money. The slave would be less productive, meaning less profit for the master, and the slave's labor might even disappear altogether. Verse 21 alludes to these financial motivators when it notes that, quote, the slave is his money. There was a cost built into beating a slave, one that the master would have preferred not to bear. Some, I am sure, will object that it is somehow wrong to beat a slave at all, but on that point, I would remind you that the Israeli slaves were slaves primarily because of a life of crime or irresponsibility. So, if they're causing trouble for their masters, to whom they already owe a debt, such that the masters believe the financial loss of giving them a beating is necessary, then the slaves aren't really sympathetic characters in that situation. We should also note that there is no record of any person enslaved to an Israelite being mistreated anywhere in Scripture. When these servants are depicted, which is rare, we get the impression that they are willing, loyal participants in the arrangement. So here's my question to the atheists out there who are denouncing the Bible as being in favor of some kind of harsh, brutal slavery. Are these commands more harsh or less harsh than your own codes of conduct? Do you, for instance, limit terms of slavery to only the seventh year? Do you demand that your government release your prisoners in the seventh year? And when prisoners are released, does the warden send them off with gifts? If a modern prisoner is beaten to death by a guard, or just beaten and loses a tooth, does he go free for it? Hey, so far as I can tell, a prisoner can be killed by the guard, and the guard who killed him won't even face charges. And if a prisoner escapes and flees to another place and lives peacefully, will he or will he not be returned to his sentence when he is found out? And if a policeman wrongly arrests a man and has him held in confinement, sometimes for years before he is brought to trial, and that man is ultimately found not guilty of any crime, will the arresting officer be executed for wrongly kidnapping and enslaving a person? Yeah, right. In all likelihood, he won't even be charged with a crime. And let's talk about debts. Do your creditors release all your debts in the seventh year? How about all those student loan debts? If you're healthy enough to work, you'll likely never get rid of those. And if you have a mortgage, it almost certainly will take you decades to pay it back, right? Are you going to get a magical, no-credit-destroying release in the seventh year? Now, you might get out of your debts in a bankruptcy, but is that more responsible and just than what is happening here in the Bible? Is it fair to the creditor who loses a fortune on the debtor's irresponsibility? Is it in the best interest of debtors who learn that they can borrow recklessly and not repay? And those debtors, do they get provision, training, and job experience along the way? And what about your taxes? You know, in 1 Samuel chapter 8, the prophet Samuel equated taking a tax of 10% to being slavery. Just 10%. And it makes sense when you think about it. If you're working 10% of your time to benefit someone other than yourself, and you're doing the work under compulsion, then you're that person's slave, at least to some degree, are you not? Well, I don't know about you, but I and many other Americans have been paying well more than 10% of our income in taxes. Well, as I'm recording, the Democratic Party is commonly known to be both the preferred party of atheists and of people who favor tax increases. That might lead us to believe that atheists favor slavery as the Bible defines it, might it not? So I want to challenge the atheists on this. You say that the Bible favors slavery, but maybe you're the one who favors slavery in the end estimation. Now, we aren't making all apples-to-apples comparisons on this. The Bible and modern governments have different systems, and those are hard to compare closely. But I think you see my point. While the standards may be different, the law of Moses and the modern civil code are both driving at solving some of the same problems. And the law of Moses, while different from the solutions devised by governments in the modern day, is not unreasonable or any more harsh. In fact, an objective comparison reveals to us that the modern system is more harsh and unforgiving than what the Bible prescribes. Indeed, in listening to this message, you might just find that you yourself are more of a slave living under worse conditions than any ancient Israelite ever was. I'm sure there are plenty of Americans who would be downright jealous to have the level of freedom experienced by an Old Testament slave, particularly when we consider that the United States at present has the highest incarceration rate in the world. And that's the point here. The law of Moses isn't about making slaves of people. The Israelites were slaves in Egypt under conditions that were far worse than those experienced by a slave in the American South. And these Old Testament laws were aimed at restricting the practice so that having been released from Egyptian bondage, these could remain a free people. So let's stop this silly talk about the God of the Bible as the God of slavery. Our God is a God of liberty. So then, we've had an overview of biblical slavery. Much contrary to the criticisms of some, we find that slavery in the Bible was an institution which, even if we don't observe it today, was not at all unreasonable. We determined that slaves served not as a result of brute force, but willingly, primarily as a way to pay off a debt or to make recompense for having committed a crime. We also found that God's laws placed limitations on the practice of slavery so that it could not be overused as it had been used against the Israelites in Egypt. The people of Israel were limited in that they could only keep slaves for a span of 6 years, in that they had to allow for redemption of those slaves, in that the slaves were not to be returned to their masters if they escaped, and in that there were limitations on physically harming a slave. This is to be starkly contrasted with the contemporary American view of slavery, in which a person is compelled to labor against his will, forced to return if he runs away, and often severely mistreated. The God of the Bible is not the God of slavery. He is the God of freedom, and having redeemed his people from slavery in Egypt, he gave laws to ensure that the kind of unjust brutality and force practiced by Pharaoh would not be repeated among his people. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.